Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care, with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD To The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Kessenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we'll hear from a variety of people, which I think perfectly illustrates the variety of what's happening on our local food scene. So for some of us, local food means something straight from the garden, and I know plenty of you can't wait to get out into the garden. So I checked in with Master Gardener Joellen Myers-Sharp, who tells us what we can actually plant now and what we should hold off on. We'll also head to Greenwood, Indiana to stop by the new Bar Rev cocktail bar in the six-month-old Reverie restaurant. Well-known indie bartender Adam Hayden tells us about the new bar and the reaction he's expecting. And we talk a lot here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio about culinary competitions and cocktail competitions, but this week, I check out a latte art throwdown and get to see what some of the city's best baristas are up to. And speaking of competitions, we'll hear from food truck owner Matt Kornmeyer of Scratch Truck about participating in the upcoming Hottest Kitchen Entrepreneur Challenge. So stay with us for more on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, you know how excited I am about what's happening on our local food scene. Farmers markets, food artisans, craft beer, new wineries and distilleries, and of course, new restaurants. I mean, I've been going on Wish TV's Indie Style program every other week for almost a year now, and I still haven't run out of new restaurants to talk about. So there's plenty happening on our local restaurant scene, and plenty of excellent food being made by our city's top chefs. Which is why I was disappointed that none of our Indiana chefs were on the finalist list of nominees for the James Beard Awards that were announced earlier this week. As is usually the case, Chicago chefs dominated the category of Best Chef Great Lakes Region. Indiana is grouped together with Michigan, Ohio, and Illinois, which means that our chefs are always up against those in Chicago. And since judges in the Beard Awards have to actually visit a restaurant and try a chef's food in order to vote for someone, well, you can imagine that more judges get to Chicago restaurants than to those in Indianapolis or Bloomington. So we still have a long way to go when it comes to getting recognition for our local chefs and restaurants. And while some of you might say that it doesn't matter what others around the country, the magazines, websites, or groups like the James Beard Foundation, what they think of Indiana and its food community. But I think it does matter, because food is so much a part of life. We cook, we share recipes, we go to restaurants and farmers markets, we follow our favorite food personalities on social media, and we talk about food. Oh my gosh, we talk about food, and all that eating and sharing and talking builds community. And that's what we're about here at Eat Drink Indiana Radio. Building our culinary community, and letting everyone know what's happening right here. Well, before we get to this week's interviews on a new craft cocktail bar and a couple of cool competitions, I thought it was time to check in with Master Gardener Joellen Myers-Sharp of HoosierGardener.com for a little backyard gardening advice. After all, it is spring now, and the garden stores are starting to fill up with seeds and tools and, of course, plants, all of which might tempt us to get out in the vegetable garden a little too early. But as Joellen tells us, there are things we can actually get in the ground now. But for others, we just have to be patient. So it's spring now, and you know, the first warm day, people are going to be there at the garden center ready to get plants. But really, truly, what can go out this early? Well, there is an informal term called coal crops, which includes cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, all the things that are really good for you, all those crucifers that are very popular right now because of their,
all sorts of health benefits, right?
Yeah, the health benefits. It helps with the immune system and everything. And so those are the things that we can really put out now. You could also put plant potatoes now. If you wanted to. Peas, a lot of people put peas out. St. Patrick's Day is the day to put peas out. That's usually the first earliest time that you can put snow peas out or regular peas out. So those would be the things that we would put out now. In another few weeks, we could put lettuce out, just sow seed. And really, lettuces, you just practically have to say dirt and they sprout. You know, it's very easy to get them going.
So what should people be doing or have done to get some of the garden beds ready for spring?
Well, first of all, they don't want to walk on their beds. That's a hard lesson for a lot of people to learn. And I've been working outside the last few days, and things are still pretty wet. And when you walk on soil that's really wet, it compacts the soil. So if you've worked really hard to build your beds, to have them be airy and light, that's good for root development. It's good for oxygen through the soil and also to get water to move through the soil. And when we're walking on it, you know, it just compacts that and undoes all the good things that we've been working on. So that would be the main thing. It's a good time now, if you can get into your beds, to cut back any perennials that you might have, tidy up any shrubs. You don't want to prune any spring-blooming shrubs now, because if you prune them now, you're cutting off the flowers that we're all waiting for. So those should be pruned about a month after they bloom. But in terms of food, we talked about what we can already put out. And so it would be good maybe if you had some compost to spread that on the bed. That's always nice, you know, a nice way to help improve the soil and also add some nutrients, you know, trace amounts of nutrients to the soil.
So what are some of the common problems that you might see early on that people could maybe start to address now? You know, are there things people do wrong this time of year beyond stepping around on the beds?
Well, they sometimes get a little too anxious to put the tomatoes and the peppers out. Those are really warm season crops. And yes, you can find them in the garden centers now. And yes, you'll even find them in gallon pots. They're going to look really big. And you think, oh gosh, I can just put this in the soil. And until the soil reaches a certain temperature, that plant is just going to sit there and be cold and miserable until it really heats up enough. And the time to put the peppers and tomatoes, eggplants, those kinds of vegetables out is the middle of May. You can push it till the 10th of May. That would be the earliest, around Mother's Day. But really any time from the middle of May to the end of May.
So we really have two more months to wait until we can really get out there and get those plants in the ground that we imagine that we're thinking of tomatoes and salads and, you know, and tossing things around and actually cooking with mm-hmm. them, right?
Yes, but you can put carrots out, beets out, you know, any of the leaves, the chards, the spinach, those can all go out. Those make great salads, you know, as we know. And also, you know, it's just the one thing about nature is it teaches us patience. We can't make the trees go faster. We can't make those plants grow faster. We just have to kind of go along with what Mother Nature's giving us. And right now it's just too dang cold to put those, you know, warm season crops out.
So are there some other things people could be thinking about or planning or starting indoors maybe?
Sure. Usually around the first half of April is a good time if you wanted to sow seeds indoors. If you wanted to sow tomato seeds or eggplants, the peppers, you could sow those indoors. You could also, in about maybe from the middle of April till about the end of April, you could sow seeds for squash, those kinds of in that family. Or you can sow those directly, but you could start them indoors if you wanted to. There are challenges with starting seeds indoors. The biggest challenge for most people is that there's just not enough light. You know, they really need ambient light. They need light all around them rather than just at the top.
if the you've got just top light on your tomato plants, for instance, they're going to get tall and scraggly. And, you know, they may not just be the healthiest specimens when it's time to put them out there. So trying to do a setup so that you've got good light all around the plants, that's a good thing. And you don't want to start them too early indoors either, because they'll just stretch and be weak plants.
And that, again, is the challenge, the trying to not give in to temptation to just do it too soon, right?
Right. I mean, I've been lusting after a greenhouse practically my whole adult life, which if you had a greenhouse, of course, you could do any of this stuff, you know, at any point and keep it alive and things wouldn't be stretched. It would have good ambient light. But, you know, unfortunately, none have ever fit in my pocket to carry around with me or to take them home with me. But yeah, I mean, it's hard, especially once the temperatures get up, you know. And so think about doing something else. Think about putting violas out there, or Johnny jump ups, or pansies, or nasturtiums, all of which are edible.
Well, now that's right. So you can eat those pretty pansies, and like I think we've talked before, the pansies are pretty tough, right?
Yes, they are. They're very tough. And, you know, they have a nice little peppery flavor to them, and they would mix really nicely with the mesclins or the spring greens that you might have already started. And you just, you know, pick those flowers and make a very pretty salad that you can have in the middle of summer, because those plants don't like it hot and they just shut down when it gets hot. So spring is the time to enjoy eating your flowers there.
Well, now that's a good point, because, you know, we do talk a lot about eating seasonally and enjoying what's here when it's here. And so there are some things that early spring is the best time for them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you're thinking about gardening, early spring is the best time for spring ephemerals. So woodland plants, you know, heavy shade plants, those are the plants that thrive in early spring, and that's their season. And so when it comes to food, you know, we're hungry for a little Johnny jump up in our salad, and they really are pretty. And you can make nice you can mix in with cream cheese, you know, you can mix the, and they're beautiful mixed with cream cheese, or, you know, roll a block of cream cheese in little pansies or in little violas or something like that, and use them for crackers, you know, for just a nice little spring meal.
Oh, now that sounds beautiful. But we need to talk also about herbs and which herbs we can start, again, you know, pining for and getting ready to put out.
Yeah, no basil yet. Well, we put the basil out when we put the tomatoes and the peppers out. But a lot of herbs we can put out now, especially the perennial herbs. So like thyme is a perennial, sage is a perennial herb. And you could probably start sowing seeds for parsley. Also is a very hardy, cold hardy. So you could put that out, the flat leaf or the curly leaf parsley, you could put that out. But I'd hold off on the rosemary and the basil, the summer savory, a lot of the annuals. You know, they're going to be like the tomatoes and the peppers. They're going to be a lot happier going out when it's warmer.
So even if we do spot them at the garden center, we should just resist them for a while.
Yeah, the ones that we talked about, like that are the perennial herbs, they're already in a lot of people's gardens, so we know that we can plant those. And I will mention one of the things: herbs are an important plant for pollinating insects, which a lot of people don't realize that. But if you've got fennel and dill, the type of flowers that those have are really good attractants and supporters for pollinating insects, and also what are called predatory insects. So those are the good bugs that go after and eat the bad bugs. And so, you know, sticking some of those in the garden when we plant the tomatoes and the peppers really helps bring all those pollinators to the garden and help increase the crop, you know, the number of tomatoes and peppers that we're going
to
get.
Oh, now that's very good to know. You know, I hadn't really thought about that, you know, about which ones, you know, are good for the pollinators, because we're all very concerned about bees and insects these days.
Yeah, herbs are at the top of the list, really, for attracting and supporting bees and other pollinating and predatory insects. I mean, we're all concerned about pollinators, but predatory insects are the kinds of bugs that would eat, like, aphids or something like that. And those are the kinds of flowers. They're called umbel, U-M-B-E-L, flowers. And they look kind of like an umbrella, like in the carrot family. And those are the ones that support those predatory insects and pollinators. So, and we can eat them too. Eat the plants, rather.
Now, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, urban gardening and urban farming. And so I know that a lot of people are interested in chickens. And so you mentioned briefly a little bit ago about how chickens might not go so well with the backyard gardening. You talk just a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is the time when a lot of the urban gardening stores and even the farm stores out in more rural and suburban areas would have little chicks ready. And so you think, oh gosh, I'm going to have chickens and they're going to be free range and I'm going to have my own eggs. Well, the thing is that chickens and gardening do not necessarily go hand in hand, because if you're having chickens roam in your garden, we think, oh, they're going to eat all the bugs in the garden. Yes, they might eat all the bugs in the garden, but they're also going to scratch the soil. And in scratching the soil, they will uproot, you know, a lot of plants, and they also might eat some of the plants that you've got in your garden, especially the greens, the lettuces and things like that. So, you know, you need to balance that out, I think. You need to either, you know, figure out a way to keep the chickens so that they're not in your vegetable or your flower gardens and still enjoy the chickens with their eggs.
Now, I've also seen a lot of microgreens in the last few years at the farmers markets. Are those things that home gardeners can grow, or are they a little too much trouble or a little too touchy? What do you think?
I think they're pretty easy. They're another one of those things where you just say dirt and they'll sprout. And we don't have to worry. Those would be actually good to grow under lights, because a lot of green vegetables don't need quite as much light to produce as your more fruiting vegetables do. And so, you know, having a nice little tray of microgreens, you know, just then now you just like harvest the little leaves and eat those. That's all you have to do. You don't have to worry about if they stretch or not stretch. You're gobbling them all down before you ever get them outside.
So if people want more information or want to follow you, because you are a master gardener, where can they go for more information?
Well, I'd like to just brag on myself for a minute, because last year I completed 1,000 volunteer hours as a master gardener, which I'm pretty proud of. But you can find me at whosyourgardener.com. Every month I list all the things that you need to do in the garden, so it's under the checklist, the garden checklist. Or you can email me at thewhosyourgardener@gmail.com.
We've been talking with Master Gardener Joellen Myers-Sharp. You can find out more on what you should be doing out in the garden on her website, whosyourgardener.com. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, Indiana's craft cocktail scene just continues to expand, and bars such as Ball and Biscuit, the Libertine Liquor Bar, and Thunderbird, and restaurants like Black Market and Bluebeard and Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine have all raised the city's awareness of craft cocktails and artisan spirits. And with a new bar, Bar Rev at Reverie Restaurant, well-known indie bartender Adam Hayden is bringing craft cocktails to Greenwood. Tell me about the concept for Bar Rev. Is that its name?
Right. That's right, Bar Rev. That's right. And we branded it on the menu as kind of the Bar at Reverie. So we help to connect those dots for folks. But really, we're trying to create a different experience with Bar Rev so that diners have options, that they know that the great meal, full-service menu available at Reverie, and then Bar Rev, we're delivering on this sort of modern speakeasy experience. So the building that we're in at Reverie and at Bar Rev is an 1861 building. So there's a lot of history. We've broken down the drywall to get back to the original 1861 brick. So it really is beautiful. And one of the things that I've talked about actually with my bar staff is that, you know, the golden age of the American cocktail, it's kind of the 1860s up through 1890s, even stretching into pre-prohibition time into the 1900s. And that history is right here in this building as well. They found, you know, old moonshine bottles in the cellar here. And I said, you know what? I mean, the drinks that we're learning, Manhattans and old fashioned, Blends, and you know, all of these great classic cocktails that stretch back 150 years, these were happening in spaces like we're in today. And that's a great guest connection point. It's a great staff connection point to help people buy into the experience that they can expect here.
Yeah. So now tell me what the reaction has been to as people peek in and have been watching the progress of the bar build out. Do you think you're going to have a good reaction from the customers?
Yeah, you know, everybody's been really enthusiastic. I mean, I think to the credit of Mark and Danny, the chefs and owner here, you know, they put exciting things on the menu, you know, guests have responded by ordering those. You know, I mean, just they sell out specials on a regular basis, bring in fresh halibut and break it down on the back line. So they're doing great, exciting, interesting things with food. So I think they've already developed a trusting relationship with guests that people are excited to see what's next. So as they get a peek at kind of the build-out and the new construction, it's beginning to take shape in the space. And they see the brick. We have a beautiful old copper still that we have on display as kind of a decorative piece. That catches a great glow. You know, we have light bulbs hanging from the ceiling. So that's all, you know, of course it's difficult to portray all that in over audio, but you know, that's the sort of experience that people look inside and they say, wow, this feels rustic, it feels speakeasy, it feels like a place where you can get a great drink. And people are looking for that.
Now, tell me a little bit about the cocktail menu that you've created here.
Great. So, you know, we're beginning with really focusing on the classics. So variations, kind of modern twists on these classic cocktails. So we're going with eight drinks to start, and we're splitting the menu, four kind of boozy and stirred offerings, and then four shaken and refreshing expressions. Reverie is really known for an extensive bourbon list. So we have a lot of whiskey cocktails that are on kind of the boozy and stirred side. We actually selected a barrel at Woodford just last week, so we'll be bringing in our own proprietary Woodford blend, and that'll make its way into cocktails as well. You know, I think that from a guest really education standpoint, this is part of the exciting thing about opening in a new part of town, is that you can give guests not only a great experience in terms of ambiance and quality of products, but you can also educate them and inform them about the tradition they're connected to, and we certainly have tried to reflect that in the menu.
Now, talk a little bit about that, about opening a craft cocktail bar in a different part of town that hasn't had those kind of options, and about a little bit about your background and how you got here.
Sure. Yeah, that's great. Well, you know what? My passion individually is really in teaching and is in education. I worked for actually years at Starbucks. I was in a senior training and development position for a long time traveled around the country delivering leadership development workshops and things. I left that to return to school to get my graduate degree in philosophy. Who knew that all these things would prepare me to be a bartender? But it's worked out that way. So I think what I try to deliver when I'm in a leadership role in a restaurant or in a bar is to help my staff feel like they're getting an opportunity to better themselves through the experience. That we're not just slinging drinks, but we're helping you improve your customer service abilities. We're helping you expand your sort of knowledge portfolio of spirits and recipes and things like that. So I think that's an opportunity to do that behind the scenes. And I think, you know, really a staff response to that. They like the opportunity. You know, there's sort of this, people feel like, well, you know, the dog in the kennel that hasn't been out in the green pastures doesn't know what it's like out there. And you give folks a taste of like, hey, look at this broad horizon. And they really respond with enthusiasm. So.
Now, how did you get to this point? You have been on the cocktail scene in Indianapolis for a long time. So tell me a little bit about that progression.
Yeah, you know, I have, you know, a lot of the folks who are leading the way in cocktails in Indianapolis, I have them to thank as mentors. So I started bar backing at the Libertine when it was under sort of the first wave of bartenders that opened that place. So Michael Gray, Josh Gonzalez, these are guys that I really look up to and have appreciated their mentorship. Adam Ramsey, can't say enough good things about all of his great experiences in Manhattan that he has given to us in the scene here in Indianapolis. I'm just a sponge when I'm around Ramsey, so I want to give him credit. Came up bar backing in Libertine, served there, and was given an opportunity to bartend. As late teens and early 20s, I was a barista in these independent coffee shops and things. And, you know, it's surprising, you know, the mind of remembering ingredients and technique, multitasking, taking orders as you're preparing a beverage. These are things that I've been doing, you know, for 15 years or so. And just applying, espresso barista experience into the bar, really there are some translatable skills there. And I think, given the nature of my, you know, philosophy degree, I love to learn, you know. So I'm always reading cocktail books and trying to be a student of the craft.
Now, how will that, do you feel like the Indianapolis cocktail scene will come down here too? Some of the people who have been, you know, following the bartenders or checking out the new places in Indianapolis, do you think you'll see some of them as well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is the great thing about the community here in Indianapolis is that, we are a tight-knit community that's expanding all the time, but there is this this core of really close relationships and great support. So I think as new people join, I mean, I think, Roger, who's at Liberty now, who came all the way here from Vegas, I mean, I think really a great example of somebody who transplanted here, who has been quickly integrated into the scene and is doing exciting things. I mean, has a dill aquavit cocktail at Libertine right now, the Spice Trader, which is delicious. So I think we're a community that wants to see everyone succeed. I've already had visits during construction from some of the guys downtown. Michael Toscano was down here checking out the place just recently. So I expect to see them out here and hope that they spread the word as well with the downtown scene. Yeah.
And you're expecting a warm reaction from the local crowd as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, within 2 weeks of launching our Facebook page, we are up to, 530, 540 likes, something like that. So, I mean, I think that's – and all we've really done is posted a few pictures, and a few witty remarks. So we haven't even been, click this button to give Facebook $20 to boost your post. You know, we're not doing that. It's just word of mouth. And we're already up to, several hundred people showing interest. So I think we'll have a great turnout. You know, the public opening will be this Thursday, 4 o'clock on, and already I think people are planning to be a part of that.
So now tell me what the hours will be. You'll be open so this weekend, right?
Yeah, that's right, this weekend. So we'll be open from 4 to midnight through the week. You know, we're going to Monday, Reverie, the restaurant, is closed. We're going to protect that closed day to start. I think that's a nice sort of the industry weekend standard. I think that's a nice way to start. So 4 to midnight, looking at Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then on Fridays and Saturdays, we'll be from 2 until 1 in the morning. And then Sundays, 2 p.m. until 10 p.m.
Now, where can people go for some more information? You mentioned a Facebook page, right?
That's right. Yep. So we're at Bar Rev on Facebook. ReverieGreenwood.com is Reverie's kind of home site, so you can find information there as well.
We've been talking with Adam Hayden of Bar Rev. For more information on the new craft cocktail bar in Old Town Greenwood, go to ReverieGreenwood.com. Well, I cover a lot of food and drink-related competitions in and around Indianapolis. Chef throwdowns, cocktail competitions, food events like Zubilation. But until this past week, I had never judged a latte art competition. So it was great fun to get to judge alongside experts at this month's League of Lattes throwdown at Pairings Yogurt and Coffee Shop downtown. And what I learned, aside from the criteria of what makes a great example of latte art, is that there's a growing coffee culture in Indianapolis that's pretty exciting. BJ Davis of B Coffee Roasters.
I have been trying to build barista community in Indianapolis for several years, but Andy came on board, and all of a sudden it seems like the coffee culture in Indianapolis has just exploded over the last 2 years. And we have more and more people getting more interested in coffee and quality coffee. And the latte art is just kind of like the icing on the cake. The cake is the best part, which is the coffee. But that doing that latte art, it's like that little bit of edge that gives you something that people remember and talk about. And it's really a lot of fun for the baristas. So we're trying to build barista culture.
Her business partner, Andy Gilman, explains how he came up with the League of Lattes idea and its scoring, which is based on IndyCar point system.
Started a long time ago. BJ and I at Beat Coffee Roasters, we were slogging it through, trying to make better coffee for Indianapolis. And we do a latte art invite competition. We get a couple people in our shop, but there's never a critical mass. Past couple years, more people have opened up. And there's been more interest in coffee just nationwide. But still, culture for coffee in Indianapolis is still someone comes in your coffee shop and they say, can I have a caramel macchiato? And I say, okay, that's fine. And they say, oh, is your macchiato in your board? I have to say, no, it's not a caramel macchiato. I'm talking about a 2-ounce drink. 2-ounce espresso is softened with a little bit of milk foam. And then I can do a caramel drink, but if not, that's different. And they'll go, oh, so there's an education. And that's fine. We're happy to educate. We're friendly about it. But, so, I want to make a better barista culture for a better coffee culture in all of Indiana, Indianapolis. I was at a coffee fest in St. Louis last year, and I went to a talk about building coffee culture in your city. And essentially, the speaker used Kansas City as his example. And people don't think of Kansas City as coffee, but it's amazing coffee. And so the question was, well, what'd you do? And his thesis ended up being the barista culture built the coffee culture. And he said, well, they had two unique things. They had several different roasters, but they also had this guy who does machine repair, and he built a space in his front of his workshop, which had coffee equipment, and he made a barista petting zoo. It was just anyone could come, and he started hosting events there. And baristas from the city, who normally don't mingle with each other, were meeting each other. They were talking. They were like, oh, let's try this machine together. And he started doing this just as a thing. And the barista culture exploded. People started caring about what they were doing more. And so I came back with this nugget that I wanted to do more. And so I got had this conversation about doing this. And like I said, I tried before. The passage just hadn't taken off. There wasn't a critical mass. So I decided to do I looked up to see if the name League of Lattes was out there. And I found it. I got it on Twitter and Instagram. I bought the website.
Oh, my gosh. So that URL was available, right?
Right. So I got it's a labor of love. And so I started this. The first time what I did is I printed off a bunch of flyers from all the coffee shops. I did it at my coffee shop, an invitation. And I wrote up what I funnily, just for fun, called the charter. But I have rules, and I talk about it. And part of what I define it as is we roast coffee, we have a coffee shop. I try to put my hand over my logo when I go. And like, I'm doing Andy, I'm not selling to you. I want to make a neutral place. Now, we don't have a neutral place like they did in Kansas City, so I wanted to rotate coffee shops and have different coffee shops like host it to continue making it neutral, and then we also get everybody's home. And so we meet each other, we get the coffee community having friendly competition, but also like, wow, latte art is this visual thing, something you can easily grasp, and it's like the core of what the barista is doing is pouring a latte. So that's why I started like focusing on latte art, and there is a tradition across the country of what's called Thursday night throwdowns, and you can look at hashtags on Instagram, TNT, and you'll find coffee. It's this thing that people have been doing for years, so that's why a Thursday night. And so to continue it, I didn't want to just stop with one. I wanted to do something to draw them in, bring it back, and to build it. So I thought of this idea of doing a season, like a sports season. And so we're doing 9 months. We're doing last Thursday of every month at a different coffee shop hosting it. And with that, there's a prize for every night. And then as we do these heads-up bracket-style thing, and as you place through the night, I take the score, and I'm using the points from the Indianapolis 500.
So you have standings, right?
So you have a standing throughout the season, and depending on how you place throughout the and the thing is also by doing that, and using like those scores of Indianapolis 500, we're baristas. We have lives, sometimes you have to close the shop, you might be able to make it. So let's say you're doing a good job, you got second place, or third place, you got 35 points, but you miss a week. When you come back, you could possibly do very well again and get back in the stand runnings. And so we're going to do a grand prize at the end.
But just how do you score a cup of latte art? BJ Davis again explained it to me and my fellow judge, Tom England of Ivy Tech, before we started.
First of all, you're looking to see if they are using the handle as a place to go, so that when you pick it up, the design is facing you.
Okay.
Then we're going, is it centered? That's our next thing. And then we want to look at color definition and which design is more pleasing.
Another judge for the event was Jay Cunningham of Intelligentsia Coffee, which is served at pairings. He explained his view on judging latte art and how a coffee culture develops.
Judging a latte art competition is really fun. It's pretty simple. You basically evaluate things like contrast, milk texture, design, obviously, symmetry, composure, and you kind of choose which drink that you'd be more likely to be attracted to.
So now, some of these were, there was a clear winner, but then some of them were very close, you know? And so what are some of the things that decide when two examples are very, very similar?
Yeah, I think that, I think you just go with your gut and which based on those criteria, which one you think is fulfilling. It's sort of like which one is sexier is how you call those close calls, which one you would want to reach for and take a swig of, and that you think is aesthetically really, really pleasing. So I think, yeah.
How do you build this kind of culture? I mean, we're just kind of starting here, right? So how does this get rolling?
Yeah, I think it's really nice to watch this the momentum of coffee culture build in a place like Indianapolis. I think this is one element of it, and I think the next, maybe there's lots of facets. You could have more sort of sensory tasting exercises, which would be a little for these kids, these young people that are professionals that are serving, pouring lattes. The latte art is only one element, and it's a great visual indicator that a lot of intention and craft has been applied to pouring something really simple like a latte. And I think the next step would be, like more sensory development, tasting exercises, and then of course like barista competitions, which get a little more technical, where people are actually tasting the drinks and evaluating the way that they've prepared espresso.
That's kind of like the next step. It's beyond just the looks, right?
Yeah, I think that what this helps cultivate is a barista, a craftsman that is able to really manipulate the ingredients to present something really beautiful. And I think the next step definitely is tasting. So you want to have these guys that can pour these beautiful designs also know that what they're doing, how it impacts the flavor. So they could pull the shots a little tighter and make it a little richer and deeper, or pull them a little longer, make it a little sweeter and fruitier. That sort of like craft is more like a chef, more like a reacting to the ingredients.
It took several hours, but we got through all the competitors. 2 cups of latte with designs created out of the frothed milk were judged head to head, and the winner moved on to the next round. Here's the reaction of my fellow judge, Tom England of Ivy Tech.
It's exciting to see so many baristas here competing, first of all, and to see how the coffee culture is like evolving in Indianapolis, and seeing how much people really are concerned about the quality of food and in this case coffee coming out of every coffee shop. So, yeah, I mean, really neat to see people on a daily basis who are doing this stuff to really take it to the next level.
And for who won this month's League of Lattes Throwdown, Levi McClish of Marion talks about why he drives all the way to Indy to compete and what it's like.
We're kind of in the middle of a bunch of cornfields, honestly, in Marion. We've been doing this really nice coffee thing in a tiny little bubble for a while, and we've been a shop for about a year and a half, and it's nice to start breaking out into the bigger coffee scene and start meeting some more of the people that live around us and do what we do. It's really cool.
Is you look very calm as you're doing it. Is it hard? It looks, the designs look hard to do.
Yeah, I've probably put like 4,000 hours behind an espresso bar at this point, you know. It's totally different doing it in competition because you're nervous, and my very first competition was just a few months ago, and my hands were shaking so bad I was just happy the milk made it in the cup. So it gets a little better each time, but I still get nervous for sure.
Now, the League of Lattes throwdowns take place the last Thursday of the month at coffee shops around the city. For more information, follow at League of Lattes on Twitter and Instagram. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, it seems like just about everyone has an idea for a food-related business. Maybe you make a killer barbecue sauce or the best cookie, or you want to launch a food truck or other mobile business. Then check out Reliable Water Services' Hottest Kitchen Entrepreneur Challenge. This year's contest kicks off April 1st, and they're looking for two types of businesses, those in the startup category, which are brand new, and those in the early stage category, which have been in business for 3 years or less. Finalists present to a panel of judges and get plenty of valuable feedback, and the winner gets some money to help launch the business or to expand it. But to find out what the competition is really like, I stopped in at a busy coffee shop to catch up with Matt Kornmeyer of Scratch Truck, whose bacon marmalade was a winner in last year's competition. So tell me a little bit about the process of the Hottest Entrepreneur Challenge.
Well, it started out, we just filled out the paperwork. So we got signed up for it, went down the path, and didn't really think much about it after the paperwork, and then they had contacted us and said that we had been accepted or actually were a finalist. So got a little excited about that, started looking more at, you know, saw who the judges were, went and did the show, so to say, and really had a good time. The thing I took the most out of it was the feedback from, you know, at the time I didn't even look at them as peers. It was just like, oh, I'm the little guy over here. But now, you know, after the feedback, they gave me the confidence to feel that, you know, this was a product that, you know, they were behind, they had confidence in, and that helped build my confidence in, yes, this is something we can do, we can get it to market.
Well, now, tell me a little bit about the product, about the bacon marmalade, right?
Bacon marmalade is a thing that we started, it's the signature item on our burger, it kind of makes our burger. It's basically a kind of a bacon jam-ish. We take bacon, onions, brown sugar, Tabasco, black coffee, and kind of cook that down for a while, and it basically kind of makes a jam or a marmalade type of consistency, and we'll spread that on our burger with gorgonzola and arugula. It gives it that sweet, smoky flavor, which pairs well with the pungency of the gorgonzola and the pepper of the arugula. A lot of people started asking, hey, do you sell this? You know, some people would say, can you sell it in a 50-gallon drum to me? I'll take it intravenously. So that kind of got the idea going. So we did a couple test cans, and we were selling it on the truck. And then when the contest came around and the feedback we got, we went ahead and started to try to ramp up production. We started selling it at Homespun, a couple of the wine and cheese stores. And we thought things were going well, and then we realized that we kind of stumbled a little bit and didn't follow all the rules that we needed to with production, on the production side.
Well, now, tell me a little bit about what the reaction was from the judging panel.
They overwhelmingly enjoyed the product, said it was very good. They liked the packaging. I think that's one thing that, looking back hindsight at some of the other people that were in the contest, I don't think they had the branding or the packaging. It was just an idea of food product, where we were one of the few that came to the event with, you know, we here's how it's packaged, here's what the costs are, here's what, you know, we had a business model set up for the product, where I think some of the other people had just the product. And that would be advice to somebody going into it. Kind of those are some of the questions they are going to ask, is, you know, cost or just simple business things. Just have an idea of how to answer those questions. But the feedback was that they really enjoyed the product. And, you know, one of the judges said, maybe I should think about selling the truck and just focusing on the marmalade. They, you know, it hit a lot of hot buttons. It was local. It had bacon. It had, you know, a lot of buzz things going on about it. So after hearing that feedback, like I said, we were very excited about it and looked forward to moving forward with it. We still plan on doing that. We just have to retool things and kind of get our ducks in a row before we relaunch the product.
So then tell me about some of the stumbling blocks that you hit along the way.
The first one, the biggest one, was that we did not go through the proper channels when it came to getting licensed for it. We just kind of assumed, hey, we're going to make start jarring this, go ahead and make it, get it out there and start selling it, which is fine, but I guess the science got in the way where we were pressure canning the product. We have to be licensed to do that. So now as we drilled down further and further into the licensing process, we saw that there's a lot of governing bodies involved. We didn't have our ducks in a row. So we kind of had to shut down and kind of retool, reevaluate. High pressure canning is a challenge for a small business. So we're going to have to look at going another way, which is either co-packing, which is a financial burden at this juncture, or change the formula to try to get it be able to fall into another category of product. So that's where we're at right now. We've been working with Purdue, trying to get some testing done to make sure that we can fall in that category and get back on. It has enlightened me, though, that there are other products that we have in our line that we wanted to bring out later down the road that we may bring out now because we know that we can get those through the process easier. Kool-Aid jalapenos. We sell a lot of those, and we figured we could probably jar that. So that's our next thing we're going to attempt. So you should hopefully see that soon.
Well, tell me a little bit more about those.
Kool-Aid jalapenos is, I read an article, and I saw in the South that they do Kool-Aid pickles. So they'll take dill pickles and pour out the liquid and basically soak them in Kool-Aid. And I was like, oh, that's cool. So I did some at home and actually enjoyed it. It was a different taste. It was a sweet, kind of salty taste, and I was like, I'm a big fan of the sweet, sweet hot kind of thing. So I was like, let me try this with jalapenos. So I dumped out the pickling liquid and poured in Kool-Aid, fruit punch Kool-Aid, and let it soak for a couple days and tried it. I was like, holy crap, this is good. So we threw it on the truck, and people enjoyed it too, and we sell, you know, quite a bit of it. It's only 50 cents, so it's just it's something that adds. It goes good on the burger. It goes great with barbecue. And we, you know, probably go through a gallon of jalapenos a month. So we figured let's try it out and see if people like it. It's, it's probably somewhat of a novelty, but at the same time, it really does taste good if you like the sweet, hot kind of thing.
But now tell me, kind of catch me up a little bit about the truck and the progress and how long it's been and how it's gone.
This June will be our fourth year in business. We were one of the first trucks. We're the ninth truck in the city. The food truck scene has exploded since then. I think there's at any given moment probably 65, 70 trucks licensed in the city. Food truck business has been good. We've initially started with the business plan was just build the brand. The first 5 years, build the brand. We've had some opportunities for growth, but I wanted to just stay true to the business plan and continue to build the brand. I've seen others, not only in this market, but in other markets, try to grow too quick, and they weren't ready for that, and they collapsed under their own weight. So we're kind of at that point that we're ready to expand. We were looking at brick-and-mortar options. The funding was kind of a challenge, so we're going to put that away for now and revisit that at another time. Probably next year we'll revisit it. But food truck business itself, we've got a lot of exposure that's been very helpful. We're on each street. You know, we've been in Indy Monthly, Nuvo, best food truck in the city. So that's really helped us out, the organic growth of the business. Each year our, daily averages have gone up. Our headcount has gone up of who we've served. Private events, special events, we actually... probably at certain times of the year could use a second or third truck. We're just saying no more than we're saying yes, which, is frustrating. But at the same time, we have to control what we do and not get crazy and expand too quickly. It is a tough job, though. It is a grind. Food trucking is a hard job. People always say, oh, I'd love to do that. I saw it on TV once, and that looks fun. It is fun, but it's hard.
People have probably seen the movie Chef. Tell me a little bit more about the reality of it.
Well, the chef, it's funny. Everyone asks me, as a food truck owner, I have never seen a movie about a food truck owner. I haven't seen it yet. I need to see it. I just don't have time. It is a hard year. Your typical day starts 6:45, 7 o'clock. You're starting your social media. You're usually at the truck by 8, starting to get things ready. You're out on the road by 10 o'clock going to your location. You get there. You set up. You serve for a couple hours. Then you shut down, you clean everything, you go back to your commissary. it's basically, if my eyes are open, I'm working. It's 7 days a week. You know, you shop on Sunday, you prep on Monday, you're back at it on Tuesday. It is a grind. It's a hard work, but it's so rewarding and fulfilling that, you know, for this right individual, it's the best thing in the world. But if you think it's going to be an easy job, just like the movie, no, you're...
But tell me what it's like, you know, you've talked about what it's like to look out and see people waiting in line for a while for your food. That must be cool.
It is. I still don't understand why sometimes I shake my head, but I have a hard time standing in line for anything. But it is rewarding to see that. And then even after standing 25 minutes in line, they'll come back and say, dude, that was an awesome burger or whatever. And that's what it's all about for us. We had... one guy at one of the office parks, he was probably a good 800 to 1,000 yards away from the truck, stood in line, got his lunch, went back to his building, came back about an hour later, and just personally wanted to tell us that that was the best hamburger he ever had. And that was it, and then he walked away. But it just, you know, makes you feel warm inside. That's part of what drives me. And I think every food truck owner at the end of the day, or every restaurateur, is that's what they're there for. There's something ingrained in them that's what motivates them. It's just to make people happy with the food that you put on the plate.
We've been talking with Matt Kornmeyer of Scratch Truck about the Reliable Water Service's Hottest Kitchen Entrepreneur Challenge. For more information on this year's competition, go to reliablewaterservices.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD To The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We've had an eclectic show today, one that I think illustrates the variety of what's happening on the local food scene. I'd like to thank Master Gardener Joellen Meyer Sharp of TheHoosierGardener.com, Adam Hayden of Bar Rev at Reverie Restaurant in Greenwood, Matt Kornmeyer of Scratch Truck and the Hottest Kitchen Entrepreneur Challenge, and thanks also to a great bunch of folks at this month's League of Lattes Throwdown. BJ Davis and Andy Gilman of B Coffee Roasters, Jay Cunningham of Intelligentsia Coffee, Tom England of Ivy Tech, who judged the latte art competition with me, and Levi McClish of Abbey Coffee Company in Marion, who won the competition. And thanks to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.